Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
He kōna e purangi tēnei nā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
The island of Niue is an uplifted coral atoll and one of the most isolated islands in the Pacific. It's roughly oval in shape, surrounded by 65 kilometres of jagged limestone cliffs. These days, it's affectionately nicknamed the Rock of Polynesia, or just the Rock. In 1774, the British explorer James Cook gave it the more uncharitable name Savage Island, because the indigenous Niueans fiercely resisted his attempt to land there. In his ship's logbook, Cook described it as an iron-bound coast, rugged and rocky cliffs, with no entrances into safe harbouring. Over the next 100 years or so, more Europeans would arrive, including missionaries, and news from the wider world would occasionally come to the island from visiting ships. In October 1915, word arrived that a large vessel was out in the harbour.
They were out in the bush planting. People were calling out, there's a manual, which is like a warship, down at the Lofi.
That's Tutonse Tuhipa.
My grandfather, Tasi Zikifu, ran from that plantation because it was apparently the last day for recruitment. And he called out, tell my mother I've gone to war.
That was the First World War, sometimes called the Great War. In 1915, the island of Niue farewelled 150 of its sons. They went off on an adventure across the world to fight for a king they didn't know. Fortunately for Tutose's family, her grandfather returned, but many would not. Whakalofalaiatu, I'm Koroi Hawkins. This is Untold Pacific History Season 2 and the story of the forgotten soldiers, the 150 men of Niue. From 1796, the London Missionary Society, or the LMS, spread Christianity to the Pacific Islands. But Niue's isolation and rugged coastline prevented missionaries from landing there for several decades. It wasn't till the mid-1800s that the LMS successfully set up a mission station in Niue. The LMS wielded influence and power alongside the Niuean political system, the village council, which was made up of members from each village and the elected role of the patuiki, or the chief of chiefs. The London Missionary Society, with the support of the Patuiki, petitioned for the protection of Britain near the end of the 19th century. Here's Margaret Poynter, author of Niue and the Great War.
The missionaries would have encouraged the Niuean leaders to seek British protection. Because there was so much imperial rivalry in the Pacific, that it was inevitable that a European country would arrive.
But in the end, the protectorate did not last for very long.
The British, by the end of the 19th century, had decided an empire was actually very expensive. They signed an agreement, but they handed it over to New Zealand.
Here's historian Hema Douglas.
It was easier for Wellington to manage the affairs of Niue than from Westminster. So that's why we ended up with New Zealand.
The political wheelhouse of Niue was now part of New Zealand, but another upheaval on the other side of the world would rattle this island. In September of 1914, the Kereru sailed into Alofi Bay with news that war had broken out between Britain and Germany. Understandably, the Palangi, or Europeans, were distraught. Reverend James Cullen wrote a letter to another missionary.
How awful it is, and how impossible for us to realize all that it must be for those at home. Our utter helplessness throws us more entirely upon God. Even in this distant island, we are greatly affected.
The LMS Resident Commissioner, Henry Cornwall, and the Island Council offered up their support, so a letter was sent to Parliament.
Men who fight. I am the island of Niue, a small child that stands up to help the kingdom of King George. There are two portions. We are offering one, money, and two, men.
And the British press reported this offer with the headline, Loyal Offer from a Savage Island. In the preceding months, over in Europe, millions of men marched through Belgium and France. In the initial clashes of the war, hundreds of thousands of people were killed or injured. Old-fashioned tactics of cavalry charges and massed infantry columns met the new realities of warfare. Artillery, machine guns, and barbed wire. But back in Niue, they committed to the cause. Henry Cornwall, Reverend James Cullen, and the people of Niue raised £164 in a few days for the Empire Defence Fund.
He organised a collection, and collected however many pounds he was able to. But the other thing he did was to organise the Niue Battalion.
Hema Douglas is referring to Cornwall. His job is sometimes described as the New Zealand Administrator and the Resident Commissioner. Another key figure in this story is Chaplain Heketaha Weah. Cornwall described Weah as pivotal in garnering the support of the Niuean people. Weah was a businessman, a leader, and a father figure in this story.
He was quite important because actually the Reverend Cullen really wanted to go with the men. Weah, it was decided that he should go. It was obvious he could speak. He spoke Niuean. That was a big thing. Cullen didn't.
So the offer was official, but a response from New Zealand would not come for several months. But that didn't matter because Niue was underway, fulfilling that promise of men.
The recruiting team would travel around the island and recruit were able to who volunteered. Not everybody was agreeable to step forward. The story goes that some of our young men actually took off and hid in the bush until the recruiting team passed. But by and large, most of these young men stepped forward.
More than 200 men began training at Alofi as the first Niuean regiment. At the time, Niue had a population of 4,000 people.
And there was no sort of restriction on the type of young men going off, who volunteered rather. It didn't matter whether you were married, unmarried, or whether you had children or not. So it wasn't unusual to find young men stepping forward who had, you know, three or four kids. There was no sort of barriers. If you wanted to go, you put your hand up.
The oldest member of the regiment was Weah, who by this time was the retired pastor. He was appointed as the army chaplain. Records suggest he was 40 years old at the time, but his granddaughter, Miriam Nicholas, says he could have been much older.
What I was told by my father, he was 50, so he would have been the oldest member to travel overseas.
While the 250 or so Niuean recruits were training, marching along the limestone cliffs under coconut palms, some tens of thousands of kilometres away, men were fighting and dying in their thousands in mud-filled trenches. Since news of the war, back in New Zealand, a powerhouse of Maori politicians, Maui Pomare, Apirana Ngata, Peter Buck, Tare Parata, and James Carroll were arguing that for Maori to be equal to Pākehā, they needed to join them on the battlefield. But British authorities were reluctant to use Indigenous troops in combat, partly because they thought white soldiers would object to serving alongside non-whites, and partly because they were paranoid Indigenous troops might turn against them. Pomare and his allies were furious about this restriction and demanded Maori troops play an equal role in the war effort. So he set about forming the Maori contingent with a recruitment drive for 500 volunteers. The call to arms was a success. The men trained at Avondale and departed for the Middle East on February 1915. Here's Margaret Poynter.
they would not be in a combat role. So they went in a support role. They were sent to Malta. They would do garrison duty. Then the New Zealand troops and others went into Gallipoli. Things started to go badly wrong there.
With the heavy losses and the opening of the Gallipoli campaign, it wasn't long before anxieties over Indigenous troops were overridden. The Imperial government requested the Māori contingent to be sent to reinforce the front. The committee agreed to this and promised to send further reinforcements if there was injury or loss of life. In Gallipoli, the contingent immediately suffered heavy casualties, with 20% killed or wounded. That's about 100 men.
The problem with war is that you have so many in regiments and battalions and things, but you have to keep on reinforcing them as they become ill or are killed. And so New Zealand needed to send in reinforcements to Gallipoli.
It was the offer sent back in September of 1914 that this small island was willing to do its part. And now Pōmare needed their help more than ever.
And I think that's at the point where Pōmare had a light bulb moment and said, I've got this offer somewhere on my desk from Niue and from the Cooks.
Here's historian Hema Douglas.
So Maui Pōmare must have thought that it would help his cause if he were to appear personally on the island and to take a hand in the recruiting process.
In October 1915, Pōmare travelled to Niue. On October 12, the troopship Te Anō arrived in the harbour, much to the excitement of the people. We already heard Tutose Tuhipa, whose grandfather was out in the plantation.
And they heard people were calling out, there's a ship down at the Lofi.
As a doctor, Pōmare conducted medical checks. They cleared 149 men and were one short of the 150 needed.
Maui Pōmare called for a volunteer, and I think a policeman stepped forward, much to the astonishment of his poor wife. The story was that she actually jumped in the water and swam after him, not to stop him, but just to say goodbye to him.
You can imagine how the families felt, not knowing if or when their husbands, fathers, brothers or sons would return. This might well have been the last time they'd see them.
My great-grandmother kissed their feet and said goodbye to them and blessed them.
Before the men left, Reverend James Cullen led a farewell service at the Alofi Church, and New Testament Bibles were handed out.
Now, if you read the accounts of the missionaries and others who wrote on the occasion, they will say that the troops looked very happy and they were willing to go off to war. But in reality, there was much anguish. There was a lot of wailing and crying. And I think to some extent, the young men going off to war, it suddenly dawned on them that they may not come back.
The men were then ferried out to the troop ship waiting in the harbour. October 19th, 1915, the troop ship Te Anō arrived in Auckland. The Niueans were marched off the ship and taken to an army base at Devonport. Camp Narrow Neck, or as the Niueans called it, Naloneke, would be home for 3 months, and right off the bat, things were difficult.
They had problems finding boots for the Niueans because their feet were too big. Now, you're talking about young men who have probably never worn, let alone see a pair of shoes, a pair of shoes in their whole life. The food was quite strange to some of them. Of course, the Kiwi diet was meat, predominantly meat. And the island boys, of course, was used to fish and taro.
Then there was the language barrier.
The great majority of them had no English. They relied on whoever was the head of their little group to pass on what they were supposed to be doing.
And the men were shocked by the climate. They were used to the tropics. Auckland must have felt freezing.
Well, the water temperatures in New Zealand waters at that time of the year would have been cold.
This is Olga Wilson, the great-granddaughter of Weir.
They would have got cold. They would have got sick.
They started having some sickness, and on Christmas Day, the first one died and is buried on the North Shore.
At just 22 years old, Vilipati, from the village of Liku, died on Christmas Day of pneumonia. 4 months later, in February of 1916, the third reinforcements of the Maori contingent, which included the 150 men of Niue and 45 men from the Cook Islands, left Auckland for Egypt. It may have been the real start of their adventure. Here's Olga Wilson again.
You know, they got to the Red Sea. These were places that they'd read about, and they were able to go there and see it. So, yeah, it would have been quite emotional.
The troop ships, as you can imagine, were jam-packed like a sardine can. No such thing as social distancing. It was an ideal environment for germs.
I think it was measles that broke out on the way to Port Said. This measles outbreak, it affected quite a lot of them.
And when they arrived in Egypt, it went downhill from there.
When they arrived in Suez, one had just died of pneumonia and was taken, and then others were taken off the troop ship and into hospital.
Private Kaimanu of Hikutawake was buried at a Protestant cemetery in Suez. Meanwhile, those who were fit enough continued with their training while their superiors decided what they would be used for.
Their role was really to back up the troops, to dig the trenches and to be the guards and to supply the front line.
Over the next month, the climate took its toll on more Niueans. Egypt was extreme. Warm in the morning and cold in the evening, and this brought on more illness.
In the trenches, where they were exposed to this constant cold and wet and miserable and muddy conditions, no wonder some of them succumbed quite easily to respiratory illnesses.
By this point, early January of 1916, the Gallipoli campaign was over, but on the Western Front, the war was still raging. Here's author Margaret Poynter.
They basically had a month training in Egypt before the New Zealand Army, they made the decision to move to the north of France, that the New Zealand, NZEF, the New Zealand Expeditionary Force, would be moved to the north of France. And basically when they moved, it was only half of the Niueans who were fit to travel.
Now they were split up, those who were sick and those who were okay to continue. Some of the army leadership understood that these men from the tropics would suffer disproportionately from illness in cold weather and argued they should be kept in the Middle East, away from the freezing cold and wet of northern France.
Allen, the New Zealand Minister of Defence, had signalled before they came they really needed to be in a warm climate. The response from the New Zealand Expeditionary Force said, no, no, it's fine, these guys are doing really well and their training's going well. No, they can come with us to the north of France. But actually, they were falling ill in a warm climate because they lacked immunity.
But in the end, those concerns weren't heeded.
They needed troops on the front, and these troops were available in Egypt. Put them on the first available ship and send them off to France.
Only 60 of the Niuean men passed the medical check and were cleared to go to France. The troop ships arrived in southern France in April 1916. From there, the New Zealand division took a 58-hour train ride closer to the combat zone in northern France. On the train, they passed green fields, meadows, even mansions in the countryside, a stark contrast to the desert. But as they got closer to the front, they would have begun to smell the stench of tens of thousands of men living and dying on a front line just a few kilometres deep, which barely moved in 4 years of brutal war. Maybe it was fortunate for the Niueans that they would never see much of that hellscape in daylight. Remember, they were part of the Pioneer Battalion, the labour force unit.
They were working through the night. The trenches were sodden. Their feet were often in water. They'd be brought back before daylight, and then they would have a rest period, and then they'd have a period of training in the afternoon where they were doing more bit of marching, rifle work, that sort of thing. But the whole idea of the labour unit was that it was they were labouring, they weren't actually fighting.
The work would eventually take its toll.
They were falling sick at an alarming rate, and I think the doctors and the health care people must have seen this and said, "Oh, this can't carry on. Otherwise, all these boys from the tropics will die."
By the time they were working in the north of France, there were only 18% of them who had not had any illness. So you've got 82%. I mean, it's a miracle that not more died.
Talking about the illnesses and facts and figures like this might seem kind of cold and sterile, but you have to imagine how this felt for each of these men. Everything was alien to them. The food, the clothes, the shoes. Many lay in hospital beds alone, surrounded by a strange culture. And the tide was about to change. The New Zealand Division headquarters made the call to pull the men out of France. There may have been a sense of relief, but as Hema Douglas points out, not all the New Ends felt that way.
But some of the young men said, "No, this is not right. We volunteered to fight. We may not get to the front line." It was almost an insult. But obviously, thank goodness somebody decided, well, you better be insulted and get the hell out of there before you die.
On the 25th of May 1916, the call was made to pull the men off the front line. In early June 1916, 102 New Ends arrived at the New Zealand Convalescent Hospital in Hornchurch, a town on the outskirts of London. They were bedraggled, dispirited and debilitated by illness.
The people of Hornchurch absolutely took them into their arms. This exotic group from the South Sea Islands, they always called it the South Sea Islands, and they were from the South Sea Islands, so they must eat fruit all the time. So they had special fruit collections and things for the Niue men, but trying to get them to the point where they considered their health to be good enough to send them back by sea to New Zealand.
The warm hospitality of Hornchurch must have been pleasant, if slightly bewildering for the Niue men. But then they had a welcome surprise. They were reunited with maybe the only people in the UK who knew anything about Niue, Reverend Frank and Sarah Laws, a married couple who'd spent decades as missionaries on the island before retiring back to London in 1910. Sergeant Major Ware, the chaplain of the Niue contingent, had written to them multiple times since departing New Zealand, and now they were reunited.
The Pakehas who could speak their language fluently, that must have been a real boost for the morale of our young men.
Sarah Laws, in particular, rolled out the red carpet for the former members of her flock.
She is an absolute treasure. And also when they went to Hornchurch, she then started arranging for little groups of men to come up to London and be taken on tours. She would take them.
And while Hornchurch offered some comfort, some of the men's illnesses were so debilitating they had to move to other hospitals. Four New End men eventually died at Hornchurch. Private Vasai, Private Moki, Private File, and Private Taleva. One gravestone has been made into something of a legend.
Prince Moki is one of the he's one of the big stories of the Niue contingent. He's from the village of Fasiao, which is there was a tiny, tiny village. He was the only person from that village that went. But Moki spun the story that he was the crown prince.
And it seems the men allowed Moki to weave this story in the hearts and minds of the people of Hornchurch because, well, they didn't say anything to the contrary.
Prince Moki! He must have been a bit of a character, Prince Moki, and he decided, well, if I'm going to go, I'm going to go out in a blaze of glory. I'm going to self-promote myself. But he was known as the Prince from the South Seas. So why not?
In the church diary, it says, quote, "Burial of His Highness, the Prince Rangatira, known as Prince Moki, New Zealand Expeditionary Force Base Depot. He had seen active service in Egypt and on the Western Front, and he died of pneumonia at Grey Towers Camp."
His name, they told us, they call himself Prince Moki. That's the one from Waiea, the buried there.
That's Alan Tano Pelosi, whose grandfather, Puleosi, was part of the 150.
We was laughing when they told us about that story.
Alan himself served with the New Zealand Territorial Forces, and in 2015 he was selected to join a contingent which visited France and England on the 100th anniversary of his grandfather's departure from Niue.
We were selected by the Niue government on the trip to northern France, around there. So very emotional, especially when we went to not far from northern France, where one of the soldiers was buried there, in the grave there. And it's like the feeling, it's different. That one and the one in Hornchurch, they got sick over there. Can't explain it. Yeah. And after we went to visit the graves, it's like the feeling is like they know we were there. We sit on the chairs, they sit on at the church where they sing songs, the Niuean hymns.
The next part of the home stretch for the men of Niue would be from England to New Zealand, with 55 men on that first ship. But again, it was marred by death.
Down that coast of Africa, five of them died. Yeah, it was all pneumonia and buried at sea. So they have no known grave, those ones. And I found them in the Karori Cemetery on a memorial arch. So I've told that story so that the people at Karori, that when they have the services there for Anzac and things, they usually always recognise the Niue men.
The Niue contingent arrived back to New Zealand between August and September 1916. There they waited in convalescent hospitals in Epsom until a ship was available. And this time, two more men died. From September 1916, the rest of the Niue contingent arrived home. A feast was put on, and the families would have been glad to see their men returned, but saddened for those who did not. Here's Hema Douglas.
When they arrived back here on the island, obviously there was much celebration for those who were able to come back. There would have been a great deal of storytelling, and to some extent, I suppose, there would have been a certain amount of boasting as well.
Or in the case of the chaplain Weir, who in the Pioneer Battalion became a sergeant major, he brought back a token of his travels, as Olga Wilson, Weir's great-granddaughter, explains.
Water, you know, that he'd collected from the Red Sea. It most probably was the size of a flask. You know how in the old days they used to have little flasks? So, yeah, he most probably filled up the flask and brought it all the way back.
And those stories are remembered today by the descendants of these men, like Lingi Sisikefu.
That's what we're thankful that our grandfather came back from war. If he hadn't come back, we wouldn't be here. And I think we need to see our past before we can appreciate what we have now. Like they say, Nofusem America kaitam muluhau. That was a saying, New Anne saying. Say, wait for your blessed days. And this is the blessed days.
The history of the New Anne contingent is a sad story, but one that the people of Niue acknowledge every Anzac Day at the RSA in Alofi and in New Zealand. The Niuean men who died in the Great War didn't run up from the trenches to fight the enemy across the battlefield with rifle and bayonet. Instead, they fought a grinding battle against the wet, cold, and disease-infested conditions which were so far from their tropical home. Today, there are gravestones of those who died in Suez, Cairo, France, New Zealand, and Hornchurch. And as we've heard, some of the men are buried at sea. According to author Margaret Poynter, about 100 men returned to Niue after almost 1 year away.
It's almost an insult, I think, to label our young men who went off to war as war heroes. I have to be careful here to explain. They were not war heroes. What they were, what they possessed, was an extraordinary amount of courage to step forward and to volunteer, knowing for what they may never come back. But they had the courage to step forward. Now, to me, that's more than a hero.
You're listening to the Untold Pacific History Season 2, and I'm your host, Kuroi Hawkins. This episode was produced by Justine Murray, executive producer is Tim Watkin, and was made with the support of New Zealand On Air. The interviews in this episode were provided by Tiki Lounge Productions, thanks to Lisa Tauma and Tuki Laumea. You can watch the Untold Pacific History series on YouTube or the RNZ podcasts and series page at rnz.co.nz. Special thanks to Margaret Poynter, author of the books Niue and the Great War and Niue 1774 to 1974, 200 years of contact and change. You can find this and other episodes in the series on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoyed this, please subscribe and give us a rating so that others can find it. Motolu kia.
Hey marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.